Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up on the Leonard Lopate Show today, two HIV-positive Brooklyn teens tell us about their recent trip to Ethiopia. That's today at noon. What if the U.S. starts a war resulting in a million refugees? How many of those refugees would the U.S. have an obligation to take in? That, of course, is no hypothetical question anymore. Last year, only a few hundred Iraqis were admitted to the United States as refugees, but pressure is now beginning to increase to take in at least tens of thousands more. President Bush's own former Assistant Secretary of State for Refugee Policy, Gene Dewey, is quoted in the Boston Globe this week saying there is a growing moral obligation, but he also predicts political pressure not to admit many. With me now to make the case for taking in many Iraqi refugees and to do some political analysis of this emerging situation are New Yorker correspondent George Packer. He is the author of the book The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, and he wrote about the refugee situation in the New Republic. And from the group Human Rights Watch, Bill Frelick, who's their director of refugee policy programs. So, George Packer, welcome back. Bill Frelick, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
George, what is the refugee situation now? How many Iraqis are fleeing and to where?
Well, what the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has said in a recent report is that there are at least 1.6 million Iraqis who have left the country since March 2003 when the war began, which is about 7% of the population. Most of them are in Jordan and Syria. Amman, the capital of Jordan, has just swollen by something like 20 or 30% with 700 or 800,000 Iraqis. Damascus has numbers that are just slightly lower. Others are going to Cairo, United Arab Emirates, and the lucky ones, if you know, you can see it in those terms, which Iraqis often do, are getting to Europe and a few to Canada. Very, very few are coming to this country.
And Bill Frelick, what is the refugee situation for these? You know, what's it like for these refugees? Are refugee camps being built, for example?
No, there are really no refugee camps to speak of for Iraqis. There are a few refugee camps for Iranian Kurds and Palestinians who are sort of stranded on the margins in the no man's lands and at the borders. But for Iraqis themselves, they're all what are called urban refugees, which means that they're essentially fending for themselves. They're living underground in the sense that they're being treated as illegal immigrants as opposed to being recognized as refugees. And so
Why would that be true in places like Syria or Jordan or Saudi Arabia?
Well, none of those countries have acceded to the Refugee Convention, and none of them have laws that or infrastructure for recognizing refugee status other than for Palestinians. And so there's a strong reluctance to recognize these people as refugees. The preference is to treat them simply as illegal immigrants, which means that they can deport them at any time they want. And in fact, Jordan has been deporting Iraqis in pretty significant numbers and turning them away at the border as well.
George, are certain groups of Iraqis most concentrated among the refugees?
Well, a lot of Christians have left Iraq. So as a proportion of their very small population in Iraq, it's probably the highest, but because their numbers are so few, much larger numbers of Muslim Iraqis have left, and they actually seem to be fairly, you know, evenly divided among Sunni and Shia. I don't think there's a pronounced tilt in one direction or the other. But what some reports are suggesting is that the Jordanian authorities, at least, are making it harder for the Shia to stay there than for the Sunnis. Jordan is a overwhelmingly Sunni country.
Anything on that, Bill?
No, I'd agree with what George just said. The other thing I would point out is that I think there are a significant number of people who are persecuted because of their actual or imputed association with the United States or with private organizations that are affiliated with the United States. And at this point, even people that are heard to speak English are under threat because there's the inference that they must be pro-American, pro-British. And I think that also applies to the Christians as well, that it's not religion per se in many cases. It's the fact that combined with they're also representing a certain professional class and more Western in their orientation brings them under suspicion as possible collaborators with the Americans.
Yeah, I would add that in a sense, to generalize, it's people who don't have an armed group that will defend them. And that has tended to be the urban, the secular, the educated, the middle class, the more westernized, and the Christian. If you've got a Sunni or Shiite militia in your neighborhood that will defend your neighborhood, then it's not always a matter of life and death to get out of the country, although some of those people are also trying to leave. But the overwhelming demographic is essentially the people without a militia, which means the people in the middle.
We're talking about Iraqi refugees and what is emerging as pressure on the United States to start admitting a lot of Iraqi refugees. Two of the people starting to place that pressure, New Yorker correspondent George Packer, who writes consistently about Iraqi, has an article in this week's New Yorker, and Bill Frelick, Director of Refugee Programs and Policy at the human rights group, Human Rights Watch. We can take phone calls for them at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. By the way, on our other story this morning about Timothy Johnson, we now have a second email citing special election law in South Dakota. So there are some people out there who are saying this is not automatic, that if he can't serve, the Republican governor gets his choice of permanent replacement senators, that there may be a developing argument here that they may have to do a special election in South Dakota if it comes to that in 80 to 90 days. So that's just something to keep an eye on. On the U.S. and these Iraqi refugees, Bill Frelick from Human Rights Watch, what is U.S. policy today?
Well, I think U.S. policy is really stuck, I hate to make a pun, but between Iraq and a hard place, in that I think there's a growing recognition of the humanitarian need, but I don't think that there's an acknowledgement politically that the United States wants to sort of open the stopgap and admit the failure of the enterprise to create a democracy in Iraq. That would be built on the shoulders of the very people that George just listed as that demographic group. I mean, these are the people that if you want a democracy in Iraq, you're going to build it on, and yet these are the most vulnerable people in the country. So there's a real conflict, and the United States, I think, the U.S. government is struggling with that. Thus far, they've not been willing to allow the humanitarian concern to trump the foreign policy goal. But I think they're fast approaching the point where they can't deny that any longer, and they're going to have to admit the moral responsibility that people have put their lives on the line through their association with the United States, and they have to be protected.
And sure enough, George Packer, there is that quote from the Boston Globe this week by Gene Dewey, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Refugees under President Bush, and he said that for political reasons, the administration will discourage resettlement here because of the quote, psychological message it would send that Iraq is a losing cause, unquote. So how much do you agree with that as political analysis?
you know, I'm just beginning to report on this, and I haven't spoken to any officials who, whether by what they say or what they don't say, could confirm for me that that's the reason. But my guess is it's a large part of the reason, and it's a large part of the reason why even Iraqis who, for example, you know, worked at the U.S. embassy or were translators with the U.S. military, are simply not being given priority for visas. And in some ways, what I hear from Iraqi friends is that in Jordan, it's almost impossible to get a visa at the U.S. embassy if you're an Iraqi. It's a lot easier if you're from another country. And so Iraqis have almost given up trying to get visas out of Jordan and are going to other countries to apply for American visas. That suggests that there is some resistance to the flood that might well follow a change in policy. And I think Bill is absolutely right that the political reason, the admission of a failure, the acknowledgement of the reality has to be a big part of that.
And so far, of these 1.6 million Iraqi refugees that you estimate because of the war, the numbers I've seen that have actually come to the United States are tiny. I saw one that said 200 last year. I saw one that said a handful. Do either of you know?
Those are the numbers that were given refugee status, which is a particular immigration status, and is the only way you can essentially be given asylum without actually being in this country to apply for it. Our asylum laws force people almost to lie their way into the country by claiming they will not go back home. They will go back home, and then asking for asylum once they get here. There may be others, in fact, I'm sure there are, who have gotten here by other means, you know, whether as visitors or on official delegations and then jump ship. I'm sure that that's happening, but the numbers are just tiny compared to both the hundreds of thousands who are in Syria and Jordan and the tens of thousands who, I would guess, have a claim on us because they cooperated with us.
We have a call from someone who has a story of a particular Iraqi, I believe, who she would like to get refugee status in the United States. Lisa in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. My husband was Stephen Vincent, the journalist who was kidnapped and murdered in Basra last year.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. When he was shot, his translator, Noor Itayas, was also shot three times. She survived, was taken into FBI custody, held incommunicado in the Green Zone for 3 months, and then thrown out into Baghdad with no wherewithal. She can't go back to Basra. Her family doesn't want her. She doesn't have any family anywhere else in Iraq. I've spent the last year trying to get her into the United States. I have been told by various government officials that, oh, she can't come to America. Iraq is a democracy. She doesn't need asylum. I have been told that her passport is not valid because supposedly there are so many forged passports out there that the American government isn't accepting Iraqi passports. I finally found somebody with a brain and a heart in the State Department who is working with me who said her passport is totally valid and we will see what we can do to get her in. But I have been given the most astonishing runarounds and lies and stories. And it's just amazing. I mean, this woman is educated. She speaks English. She speaks Arabic. She is pro-democracy. She would probably be a very good person to work with various agencies in America. She has a lot of information.
And so, Lisa, do you get the impression that you're getting the runaround because they don't somehow want to tacitly acknowledge the gravity of the situation or defeat in some way by allowing someone like her to come in under asylum status?
Yes, that I truly believe that's why they said to me with a straight face, but Iraq is a democracy. Why should she apply for refugee status or asylum?
George Packer, do you want to talk to Lisa? And you have a story, I think, a concern about your own translator from there, right?
I would love to talk to Lisa. First of all, my condolences, Lisa.
Thank you.
I was in Basra at the same time as Stephen, but I saw him at the hotel there, but I actually never introduced myself, and I wish I had because I began reading his blog after his death, and it's an absolutely wonderful insight into Iraq that very few journalists were able to get.
Thank you.
One of my translators has a Fulbright. for next year, but that means he can't leave until something like June. And you just sense that the wolves are closing in, that people in his neighborhood are just being picked off one at a time. His brother was recently shot but survived. And I share your sense of frustration and despair, because you just don't know, you know, where to turn and how to sort of break through all of this bureaucratic resistance that is obviously at heart political, because it means an admission of a failure of the project. And I wrote an article in the New Republic, it just because I wanted to sort of break through this and say, at least let's start paying attention to it, and hopefully public pressure will begin to form. But one of the responses to the article, by way of sort of web comment, was, why should we let a bunch of potential terrorists into this country?
So I didn't hear that one.
There's going to be some resistance.
Well, that represents a certain kind of populist resistance. And
yes,
Lisa, I'm going to move on, because I want to take a call from an Iraqi who's calling in. But thank you so much for calling. And
thank you.
It's really important that you got your story out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And good luck, Mr. Packer.
I'd like to talk to you again.
Fuhaib in Morristown. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm the secretary of the Mendaian Society of America. I'm a physician in Morristown, New Jersey.
Explain to people what the Mendaian Society is.
Mendaians are a small, ancient religion indigenous to Iraq. We follow John the Baptist. We're agnostic by doctrine, and we lived in Iraq for at least 2,000, 2,500 years. We are been subjected all the time throughout history to a problem, which is not being recognized as are we infidel or not, although we were mentioned in the Quran three times, but we were always had the problem, and we were always at the mercy of the local clerics or authority or whatever.
And forgive me for rushing you, but we're going to run out of time. What's the situation now?
The situation in Iraq is dire, especially after the war. And Mendaians are being kicked, being killed, being kidnapped, being raped, being etc. And they're considered infidels. So all these things were legitimized, between parentheses, by religion doctrines, by Islam. So most of the community has actually fled to Syria and Jordan. However, in Syria and Jordan, the situation is definitely as bad or as worse, although there's no killing, but they are being used, abused,
right,
sexually abused, child abused.
So another group that, because of the sectarian violence, finds itself as a minority in a vulnerable position. And Fuhaib, forgive me again for cutting you short, but thank you for your call and getting that important story out. Before we run out of time, Bill Frelick from Human Rights Watch, does Vietnam, after that war, present a historical lesson in this regard or model?
Yeah, I think it actually does. It was a failed foreign policy endeavor, and the United States had a moral obligation, which it recognized, to protect particularly the people that were associated with it. But there was also there were religious minorities and others that were also of particular concern to the United States.
How many Vietnamese refugees actually came to the U.S. after the war? Do you know?
Well, I know that more than 1 million were resettled to various countries. I don't know that it actually reached 1 million in the United States, but it was probably pretty close to that.
And George, in one of your articles, you compare the situation in Iraq more to Cambodia than Vietnam.
Just because the level of brutality in Cambodia, the sort of sweeping violence against anyone who even, you know, appeared like they might have been pro-Western, whether they wore glasses or spoke English or were a teacher or whatever, reminds me more of the indiscriminate violence against those types of people in Iraq than the more orderly repression in South Vietnam after the war with re-education camps. My imagination is filled with apocalyptic scenarios when I think about how this civil war might devolve into something more, even more catastrophic than it is now.
So what are you calling for, Bill Frelick?
We are calling for a significant resettlement program. The United States, as you mentioned, resettled around 200 Iraqi refugees from the entire region last year. And in fact, getting back to the earlier point about the terrorism, they had suspended any resettlement of Iraqis until mid last year from the point of the 2001 attacks on anti-terrorist grounds. They have budgeted for 500 refugee admissions for the coming fiscal year, which is, again, less than a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's just minuscule. And
you have a number that you would propose?
Well, it has to be far greater than that, and then part of what they need to do is to switch gears, because they're working through the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. They're waiting for referrals in a very slow process. It's under-resourced and under-financed, and they need to, really on a bilateral basis, make some group determinations, like the Mandean gentleman that spoke earlier.
That's where we have to leave it. And I want to thank Bill Frelich, Director of Refugee Policy at Human Rights Watch, and George Packer, who has an article about Iraq in The New Yorker this week and is the author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org, and thanks.